For this Tuesday, May the 4th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. The president announcing what he is calling a new phase in the U.S. COVID vaccination effort, now aiming to administer at least one dose of the vaccine to 70% of the adult population by the 4th of July. There are more divisions among House Republicans. GOP leader Kevin McCarthy of California saying the party is losing confidence in Representative Liz Cheney. She is currently number three in the House leadership. The U.S. trade deficit surging to a record $74.5 billion in March as an improving U.S. economy driving purchases of imported foreign goods. And the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, former Fed chair, speculating that interest rates may have to rise if government spending stokes higher inflation. The Supreme Court holding its last oral argument of the term today, looking at sentencing penalties for some low-level drug convictions. The story shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House, where President Biden today announcing a goal to administer at least one shot of the COVID vaccine to 70% of U.S. adults by the 4th of July, in 2 months. It comes as the administration moves to vaccinate harder-to-reach Americans, ensuring that as many as 160 million adults will get the full vaccination. More with the president.
2 months from today, 2 months from today, families across the country are going to celebrate the 4th of July. Our goal by July 4th is to have 70% of adult Americans at least one shot and 160 million Americans fully vaccinated. That means giving close to 100 million shots, some first shots, other second shots, over the next 60 days. Of course, Americans can still get shots after July 4th, but no one should wait. Let's try to hit that 70% mark, at least with one shot before that day. It's another huge goal. And as you may remember, we were initially focused on getting enough vaccines for every adult. Well, we did that. We have enough vaccines. Now that we have the vaccine supply, we're focused on convincing even more Americans to show up and get the vaccine that is available to them. If we succeed in this effort, as we did with the last, then Americans will have taken a serious step towards a return to normal.
The president earlier today from the state dining room, he also took questions. We posted the full event on our website at cspan.org. According to the CDC, the average number of shots per day has been falling in recent weeks, although we're still seeing about 2.2 million every day here in the U.S. And the president setting another goal, making it easier for Americans to get the vaccine even in more rural areas. More from the White House.
So starting this week, we're also going to direct all federal pharmacy partners to begin to provide walk-in hours. You'll soon be able to get vaccinated without an appointment at the vast majority of our 40,000 pharmacy locations across the country. We're also encouraging our state and local partners to have a walk-in ability as well to the sites that they run. And beginning next week, we'll be shipping new allocations of vaccine to rural health clinics, getting more vaccines to more rural clinics so Americans who don't live near one of the 75,000 vaccination sites will have new options that may be closer than anything they thought. We know that vaccination rates are lower in rural areas, and that's why we're going to get vaccines closer than ever to rural residents. Also, as we wind down the large mass vaccination sites, we'll move towards smaller locations, even more convenient to the unvaccinated. So, for those who don't want to drive the distance to a large vaccination site, we'll have sites, smaller sites, closer to the unvaccinated. And for the first 100 days, our goal will be to make it possible for people to come and get vaccinated and will succeed beyond anyone's expectations, I believe. Now we're going to have to bring the vaccine to people who are less eager.
From the White House earlier today, and this headline from rollcall.com, vaccinating kids for COVID-19 posing additional challenges for officials. With more on that part of the story, Ariel Cohen, who covers it for CQ Roll Call. What are the challenges as children head into summer camp and, more importantly, back to school full-time in the fall?
Well, as you know, a vaccine hasn't yet been authorized for young teens. The youngest you can be and get a vaccine right now is 16 years old, although the White House does anticipate that the Pfizer COVID vaccine will soon be authorized for kids age 12 to 15, which is just a sort of small segment of the overall pediatric population. So some issues that a lot of advocates are looking out for is how do we ensure that these vaccines are distributed in an equitable way, and some of the issues that we've run into with the vaccination process for adults don't get repeated in terms of not being able to access the vaccine or vaccines not necessarily making it to lower income neighborhoods and things like that.
What about pediatricians? Is it safe to assume that if you need a vaccine, the first stop, if available, would be your local family pediatrician?
For a lot of kids, yes, it would be safe to assume that. The Biden administration is partnering with a lot of pediatricians' offices and making sure that they know how to give out the vaccine and that they have vaccine supply. So that will be great for a lot of kids. They'll be able to go to their pediatricians' offices, get the shot, and hopefully kind of resume normal life. But for a lot of other kids, a pediatrician's office isn't necessarily their first option. Maybe they don't have a trusted pediatrician they go to all the time. Maybe they're in a rural area and it's harder to access healthcare. So a lot of childhood healthcare advocates are sort of advocating for this to be done in other settings that kids may commonly go to, such as schools or after school programs. You basically have to get the vaccines to where kids are, because with kids, unlike adults, there's sort of this extra layer, right? The parent has to set up the appointment and take them there. So that creates an extra layer of complexity in getting kids vaccinated.
We're talking with Ariel Cohen. She is healthcare reporter for CQ Roll Call. If kids are left unvaccinated, what are the potential problems? What are the concerns, especially with new mutations and new viruses possibly spreading around the country and around the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you raise a really good point. I mean, kids are at less of a risk for contracting severe disease from COVID or dying from the virus, but you know, it's still possible. It still happens. But the real concern that a lot of health experts have right now is that leaving kids unvaccinated could lead to new, more dangerous virus mutations and sort of slow down protections as we crawl towards herd immunity. Already, virus variants are causing more infections in children, largely because they are unvaccinated. And as more infections sort of create, you need a host to create a new variant, right? So the more unvaccinated children there are, the more hosts there are. And scientists are really worried about what sort of mutations will crop up and what that will mean for, you know, our vaccine protection and herd immunity in general.
The story can be found this evening at rollcall.com. Ariel Cohen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also here in Washington today, the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, testifying before a House Appropriations Subcommittee to talk about the department's budget. Lawmakers, though, using the hearing to ask a lot of questions on everything from national security, homegrown terrorism, voting rights, and border security. Now, the Biden budget for the Department of Justice, which was unveiled last month, totals just over $35 billion. That's about a 5% spending increase. The Attorney General did spell out some of his concerns on foreign and domestic terrorism, and he outlined the role police departments need to play and should play in protecting communities while ensuring civil rights for all its citizens.
Almost 65 years after its creation, the Civil Rights Division's work remains vital to addressing unlawful discrimination and bias. Our budget seeks to increase the department's civil rights funding by $33 million, providing a total of $209 million for the Civil Rights Division, the Community Relations Service, and related civil rights work. From protecting voting rights to prosecuting hate crimes like those experienced by our Asian American and Pacific Islander communities during the pandemic, DOJ's civil rights work is critical to protecting the American dream. Another highlight of the president's request is an historic investment of $1 billion to support the work of the Justice Department's Office of Violence Against Women. The important grant programs administered by OVW will assist our state, local, territorial, and tribal partners in addressing gender-based violence. In addition, $120 million is provided to expand our efforts to address widespread rape kit backlogs and to fund new investigative training programs for law enforcement officers and prosecutors in units dedicated to investigating gender-based violence. Promoting public trust between communities and law enforcement is essential to making both communities and policing safer. Our budget proposes increased investment in programs that support community-oriented policing and addressing systemic inequities, including $1.2 billion, an increase of $304 million.
And that's from the Attorney General, part of his opening remarks before today's House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. He did face a number of questions from Republican lawmakers about migration towards the southern border, noting that the president's budget proposal would add as many as 100 new immigration court judges. Stephen Pelosa represents Mississippi's 4th Congressional District with this line of questioning on security along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I would like to briefly address the crisis that we have on our southern border. It seems to be somewhat of a manufactured crisis, but it is a crisis. It is a huge challenge. We basically have an invasion taking place in our southern border. And listen, I know we got to handle this in a humanitarian way, and I'm all for that. But we're also a nation of law and order. And without law and order, we're creating chaos. My biggest concern is the flow of people, not those who are coming through the points of entry, but it's the ones that are taking advantage of this crisis. And it's the human trafficking, it's the drug smuggling, it's the bringing in of foreign nationals, some who have been apprehended that we know are on the terror watch list. So can you address what is the Department of Justice seeing at the border? Are there foreign actors coming across that are could be dangerous? I mean, what are we doing? I mean, because we all respect you know, the FBI and our law enforcement communities and officers. And I just feel like that we're just adding a huge burden upon them, but more so upon our local law enforcement officers who are going to have to be basically dealing with the criminal activity that's coming across and the hard narcotics in their backyards. Can you quickly address what the Department of Justice is doing? And how are you advising the administration to get this under control?
Look, the issue of major narcotics traffickers sending narcotics across the border is a vital concern to us, particularly now the transition to the synthetic opioids, to the fentanyl analogs. The precursors of these are coming in some part from China, moving into Mexico, then moving across the border. We have put a lot of effort into interdiction and into enforcement on this. We're spending $2.2 billion in the current FY21 budget across DOJ for immigration, Southwest border enforcement. This funds our DEA agents, and as I mentioned in the previous question, our prosecutors in the Southwest border. One of the first things I did internationally as Attorney General was to speak to the Attorney General of Mexico to seek and confirm his cooperation with respect to fighting transnational narcotics organizations, and he pledged his support to this as well. So this is a serious problem, and we are seized with it.
Merrick Garland is the U.S. Attorney General. Today's House Subcommittee hearing, as with all of our coverage, it's available online anytime at cspan.org. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris saying the influx of migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border cannot be solved without cleaning up corruption in Central America. She did describe the current situation as, in her words, alarming. As background, the vice president was tapped 5 weeks ago to lead U.S. efforts to stem the surge in illegal border crossings. She criticized El Salvador's parliament for voting Saturday to oust judges on the country's Supreme Court and referred to relentless corruption in Guatemala. And she noted the administration recently boosted USAID to Central America by an additional $310 million with a goal to stem the flow of those migrants here to the U.S. Her remarks in Washington at a conference of the Americas meeting.
Our administration wants to help. We want to pick back up the kind of work President Joe Biden started when he was vice president. We want to help people find hope at home. And so we are focused on addressing both the acute factors and the root causes of migration. And I believe this is an important distinction. We must focus on both. First, the acute factors, the catastrophes that are causing people to leave right now. the hurricanes, the pandemic, the drought, and extreme food insecurity. And then there are the long-standing issues, the root causes. And I'm thinking of corruption, violence, and poverty, the lack of economic opportunity, the lack of climate adaptation and climate resilience, the lack of good governance.
That from Vice President Harris earlier today. She then traveled to Milwaukee to promote a plan for clean energy, touring the University of Wisconsin's Service and Research Building in that city. One additional note, the vice president is taking on a new role. We learned over the weekend that she will head up the National Space Council. Now to the political infighting within the House GOP. CNN's Manu Raju, he covers Capitol Hill, posting the following story at CNN.com. Quote, Representative Liz Cheney's days as the number three in the House GOP leadership appear to be numbered, with speculation growing about her replacement and House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy contending that she has failed to do her job in driving the party's message to take back the majority. Congresswoman Cheney has grown increasingly isolated within her conference amid her feud with former President Donald Trump, a battle that intensified after she was just one of 10 Republicans who backed his impeachment on a charge of inciting the January 6th insurrection, and she has called out his lie that he actually won the 2020 election. The full story at CNN.com. Now, prior to his appearance on Fox News this morning, Leader McCarthy was caught on a hot mic. The audio has been posted on the Drudge Report website, Axios.com, and Mediaite. Here's what he said prior to going on the air.
I think she's got real problems. I've had it with her. It's, you know, I've lost confidence. Well, someone just has to bring a motion, but I assume that will probably take place.
That from Leader McCarthy on Representative Liz Cheney, and shortly after that off-camera moment, he appeared live on Fox and Friends.
On the Republican Party in the House, you are the number one Republican in leadership. Steve Scalise is number two. Liz Cheney is number three. There are a number of reports out right now, Leader McCarthy, that some of your allies are saying we're unhappy with her in leadership because she voted to impeach President Trump, and now they're vowing a vote to get rid of her. What can you tell us about that?
No, there's no concern about how she voted on impeachment. That decision has been made. I have heard from members concerned about her ability to carry out the job as conference chair, to carry out the message. We all need to be working as one if we're able to win the majority. Remember, majorities are not given, they are earned. And that's about the message about going forward. Combating Joe Biden, what he's done to this border by making it insecure and what's coming across. Just what he's doing here about small businesses, not opening schools, not getting us back to work, back to health, back to normal. That's the message we should be talking about. I haven't heard members concerned about her vote on impeachment. It's more concerned about the job ability to do and what's our best step forward that we can all work together instead of attacking one another.
Kevin McCarthy is the House Republican leader. He made his comments earlier today on Fox and Friends. And joining us here in Washington is Scott Wong. He is covering the story for The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. First, what is the very latest on what's happening among House Republicans?
Well, Steve, there's a lot of moving parts here, and there's a lot of maneuvering behind the scenes. What I can tell you is that Kevin McCarthy went on Fox News early this morning and echoed what he was hearing from the majority of his Republican conference, that there is a vote of no confidence in Liz Cheney as the Republican conference chairwoman. She's in charge of messaging. She's the number three leader in the House Republican conference. And she's been making waves in the conference lately because of her outspokenness about President Trump, saying that the party needs to shift away from the former president. She, as you remember, was one of 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Trump. And so she has drawn the ire of a number of the former president's allies. That list of opponents seems to be growing in recent days and weeks. And so now there is a real push led by McCarthy allies to remove her from her leadership position. Today was the first time we really saw McCarthy go after her and really detail the ways that he believes she is undermining the party's messaging, undermining the party's chances of reclaiming the House majority in 2022. And so there is a lot of behind-the-scenes jockeying right now as some key members of the Republican Party look to not only remove her, but some of them are looking to replace her on that leadership team.
Well, let me follow up on that point. Who is currently vying or considering vying for this position?
So we know at least one person who has taken himself out of the running. We can now say that Jim Banks, who I just got off the phone with, told me that he is going to remain in his position as Republican Study Committee chairman. That's the largest conservative caucus on Capitol Hill. He had been openly critical of Cheney, some of Cheney's messaging strategy in the press and to reporters. And so a lot of people thought maybe he would jump in and try to challenge her. But he just told me that he is going to remain at the RSC. That sort of paved the way for some other folks. Two women have emerged as central figures in this race to replace Cheney. One of them is Elise Stefanik of New York. If you remember, she was just 30 years old when she was elected in 2014, the youngest woman ever elected to Congress at that time, and has since made a pretty big name for herself as a Trump loyalist, especially in that 2019 first impeachment proceedings for Donald Trump, where she was emerged as a critical defender of Donald Trump. The second person that we're hearing about is an Indiana Republican named Jackie Walorski. She is not as well known as Elise Stefanik, but she's very well respected on Capitol Hill. She is like Stefanik, a McCarthy ally, a Trump ally, and she is currently serving as the top Republican on the Ethics Committee, which is shows you how close she is to Kevin McCarthy, that McCarthy would entrust her with that position. And so those are the names. There are other names we're hearing, but by and large, the consensus seems to be that that Republicans want to replace Liz Cheney with a female candidate because there really is a lack of females on that leadership team. In fact, I looked at the list of the top six or seven leaders under Kevin McCarthy, Steve, and only one of them, Liz Cheney, was female. And that creates a bit of a problem for Republicans as they're trying to expand their party and really target some of these female suburban women voters that they lost in the last couple elections in 2018 and 2020. If they want to be successful and win back the House majority and win back the White House and Senate down the road, they need to be able to appeal to female voters. And one way they can do that is by having women on that leadership team.
We're talking with Scott Wong. He covers Congress for TheHill.com. Bottom line, what is the timeline for this? If they replace Representative Liz Cheney, when could that happen? When do House Republicans meet again?
Steve, they don't meet until May 12th, next week. And that buys a little bit of time for Liz Cheney. Right now, tempers are very hot, especially after Cheney made some national headlines at the GOP retreat down in Orlando, Florida last week, where she really publicly broke with Kevin McCarthy in front of all the reporters and in front of all the cameras on a couple key issues. One was on who the leader of the Republican Party was. She said it was Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, not Donald Trump. And secondly, she broke with McCarthy on the scope of the January 6th commission that will be investigating the attack on the Capitol on that day. She said it should be a narrow scope of an investigation. McCarthy wants a much broader scope. And in saying that, she actually aligned herself with Nancy Pelosi rather than with the leader of the Republican Party, Kevin McCarthy. And so that drew a lot of frustration and ire among some of her colleagues. And so we won't see the House back in session until May 12th. That buys Cheney a little bit of time, but from talking to Republicans, they really see the writing on the wall and say they don't see how Kevin McCarthy and a lot of people who stood by Cheney back in February during that vote to oust her, they don't see how he can do that again. They believe that Kevin McCarthy will be working against Cheney in this next vote. We don't know exactly what day that will happen, but without cover from Kevin McCarthy and a number of his allies, people don't believe that Liz Cheney can survive a second vote.
A story we will be following, Scott Wong from The Hill newspaper. Thank you for being with us.
Of course, anytime.
And this related note, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, among those Republicans who still voted against certifying President Biden's election when Congress resumed voting in the evening after the riot back on January the 6th. The Missouri Republican maintains that he was not going to allow, as he called it, the lawless criminal mob to affect his plans to raise concerns about election integrity. Former President Trump has repeatedly claimed that widespread fraud resulted in a rigged election. More from today's conversation with Senator Hawley, hosted by The Washington Post.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the investigations that are going on into the Capitol riot. Do you support a 9/11 style commission to look into those events?
You know, I agree with my fellow Republican senators here that I think a commission would be useful, but it's got to be truly bipartisan and ought to be done on the framework, on the style and the pattern of the 9/11 commission, which is not what the Democrats had proposed, not what Nancy Pelosi's proposed. She wanted it to be a stacked partisan commission, which is why it's currently bogged down, because there's no reason to further introduce partisan politics into this. We ought to have a clear look at the security failings. You know, we've had several rounds of hearings in the Senate on the security failings on the day. Those are pretty significant. We know, for instance, that there was major controversy about activating the National Guard. We know that some did not want the Guard activated on the day because of they thought it looked too much like President Trump's activation of the Guard against the rioters in D.C. earlier in the summer. I think that was a mistake to not activate the Guard earlier on the day. And there's a lot of controversy about who asked for it to be activated, when it was activated, et cetera. I think we probably should have a full accounting of all of that, making sure that the various law enforcement agencies were coordinating and figuring out how we can improve. You know, I had a Capitol Police officer take me aside the other day and say, you know, is anything going to be done proactively, or is it just going to be a blame game looking back? And I think that he had it exactly right. I think something that a commission could do, a nonpartisan commission, is think about proactively, what are we going to do to make sure that security failings like this don't happen in the future? Take a look at the physical security of the Capitol and so on.
And that from Senator Josh Hawley, the conversation posted at WashingtonPost.com. Here are some international headlines. A Mexico City subway overpass collapsing today, sending a train plummeting onto a road below, killing at least 27 people. Children are among the dead. More than 60 others were injured. Some of the images from the scene showing the twisted wreckage of the train cars hanging from the overpass. And the first secretary of the Swiss embassy in Tehran found dead today after falling from a high-rise building where she lived just north of the city. The Swiss foreign ministry saying that the employee at its embassy in Iran died of an accident without identifying the victim. You're listening to Washington Today. On this Tuesday, May the 4th, here are some of your political headlines. Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist making it official today, announcing his plans to run for governor in his home state of Florida to challenge Governor Ron DeSantis if he gets the Democratic nomination. He is a former Republican, elected governor himself back in 2006, 4 years later opting to run for the U.S. Senate, losing to incumbent Senator Marco Rubio before switching parties. And in the California recall race, Caitlyn Jenner releasing a new 3-minute video on her YouTube page attacking incumbent Governor Gavin Newsom. The recall vote is slated for November. A former Fed chair and now Treasury Secretary weighing in on the economy and interest rates. Secretary Janet Yellen saying it is possible the Federal Reserve may have to raise interest rates to keep the economy from overheating if the Biden plan is enacted. It comes as the president is proposing an estimated $4 trillion in new spending on infrastructure and social programs over the next 10 years. That includes funding for roads and bridges, research and child care, as well as paid family leave. In an interview with the Atlantic's Future Economy Summit, she said, quote, "It may be that interest rates will have to rise somewhat to make sure that our economy does not overheat, even though the additional spending is relatively small relative to the size of the economy. At today's White House briefing, Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked to respond to those comments.
You mentioned Secretary Yellen is coming on Friday. She said in remarks published today that it may be that, quote, interest rates will have to rise somewhat to make sure that our economy doesn't overheat. Does President Biden agree with her?
I think President Biden certainly agrees with his Treasury Secretary, but I will say that one of the reasons I think you're asking this question is about inflation concerns and something that we watch closely here, obviously in the Treasury Department and in the White House in close coordination. And that is something where there's agreement. I looked at Secretary Yellen's remarks, or the ones that I saw, which she also conveyed, is how vital it is to make these investments now and how important it is for our economy, for investment in research and development, for leveling the playing field on the workforce to make exactly this investment. So, of course, officials who don't work here in the Federal Reserve and other places closely watch what needs to happen. I'm not going to speak on interest rates, but we also take inflationary risk incredibly seriously, and our economic experts have conveyed that they think this would be temporary and that the benefits far outweigh the concern.
I ask in part because, of course, the previous administration was routinely criticized for repeatedly sharing its views on what rates should do. Secretary Yellen is expressing her view on what will happen to rates. Do you think that this is an appropriate comment for a Treasury Secretary? I mean, is she expressing an opinion on what the Fed should do when she says this?
Well, I would say of all people, Secretary Yellen certainly understands the independence and the role of the Federal Reserve. And I think she was simply answering a question and conveying how we balance decision making here.
That from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And again, Janet Yellen is the former Fed chair. Fox News is reporting that former President Trump has launched a new platform which will eventually give him the ability to communicate directly with his followers after months of being banned from sites like Twitter and Facebook. The platform called, quote, From the Desk of Donald J. Trump, appears on the Donald J. Trump website. It will allow the former president to post comments, images, and videos. Now, this development comes one day before a Facebook oversight board will review the company's decision to block the former president from the social media site. This is the Wall Street Journal headline, Inside Facebook Jail, the secret rules that put users in the doghouse. And, of course, one of its most famous users was former President Trump. Late this afternoon, we spoke to reporter Kirsten Grind about the board and what to expect tomorrow.
This is a story basically about what it takes to get a ban on Facebook or get them to remove your content. And it's now known by some users as Facebook jail when you get a ban. And many users are frustrated and confused about why their content is being taken down and why they received a ban. And all of this is important right now because tomorrow, this entity known as an oversight board, which is independent of Facebook, is going to rule about whether Facebook should allow back on former President Trump. They had earlier this year taken him off the platform after posts related to the Capitol mob earlier this year.
And as you point out in your piece available at WSJ.com, this oversight board looking at potentially more than 220,000 appeals from users. So how does this process work?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So the oversight board was set up by Facebook last year because it was under so much pressure for the content decisions that it was making. And it's made up of a group of 20 outside experts. But the way to think about it is basically like a Supreme Court, right? They are not ruling on every single minutia decision that's happening on the platform. So a lot of the focus has been on high-profile figures like President Trump and other figures that have been banned or kicked off of Facebook or Twitter. Well, on the ground floor, there's all these billions of users that every day are posting comments and, you know, trying to deal with all these crazy rules that they don't understand. And the oversight board can't really touch all of that, right? That's not really their role.
And I'm assuming the content, those postings, those photos, into the millions each day, correct?
Definitely. So Facebook has a large team of moderators, 15,000, and each day they're reviewing about 2 million pieces of content. So just on the Facebook platform.
Specifically with the former president, walk us through the process and when we will know whether or not he's allowed to go back on Facebook.
So the decision will actually be made tomorrow. It will be publicized on Wednesday. And what happens is the oversight board can get a case that a user has appealed to them, so with their own content, or they can get a case recommended from Facebook. And so Facebook, you know, in this case, Donald Trump is such a, you know, prominent figure. And so the oversight board took an extra look about Facebook's decision to take him off the platform.
How much pressure has Mark Zuckerberg been under here in Washington among lawmakers?
Oh my gosh, it's enormous. I mean, Facebook has grown so big. Every month there are almost 3 billion active users, and it's under so much pressure to police the content on its platform. Mark Zuckerberg or other Facebook executives are constantly testifying about various aspects of how they're handling content, how they're dealing with misinformation on the platform. And so it's because of this, really, that over the years they've had to increase their rules for what you can and can't say on the platform, which to the public is known as their community standards, which is a document that's online on their website.
The story available tonight at WSJ.com. Kirsten Grind joining us from San Francisco. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
On Wall Street, modest gains for the Dow, up nearly 20 points, but some big losses for the NASDAQ, losing 261 points, the S&P down 28. The Supreme Court today weighing whether certain low-level crack cocaine offenders are eligible for reduced prison sentences under federal law. In oral arguments heard by teleconference, the justices questioning a pair of criminal reform measures that Congress had passed, in part to address the often harsher penalties given to minority drug offenders. Now, the court appears to be split over whether Congress meant for the same leniency applied to some serious offenders would also apply to those convicted of possessing only small amounts of drugs. How the Supreme Court resolves this could affect sentences for hundreds of low-level offenders. Here is one exchange with the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and a public defender, attorney Andrew Adler.
Counsel, if we extend the First Step Act into subsection C, as you argue we should, because you're concerned about the crack cocaine disparity. But wouldn't that also extend to other drugs? Because subsection C covers the waterfront. It's not just a crack cocaine provision.
No, Mr. Chief Justice, because sections 2 and 3 modified the statutory penalties only for crack cocaine violations. The penalties remain exactly the same for every other drug. And Congress, of course, knew that when it was drafting Section 404. It knew that Sections 2 and 3 were only about crack cocaine, and that was the purpose of Section 404, was to just make those two provisions retroactive. And so that wouldn't have even been on Congress's radar when it was drafting Section 404. And, of course, we have to keep in mind the overall statutory scheme and structure and context here when we're interpreting Section 404. And, of course, crack cocaine is part of the element of the offense under B1C. And so I just don't think that's a realistic concern here. And in fact, no court in the country has granted Section 404 relief to a non-crack offender, and no court in the country will do so if the court rules in our favor here.
Now, some background on this case. It involves Tara Rick Terry, who was arrested back in 2008 in Florida for possession with intent to distribute just under 4 grams of crack cocaine. Terry, who had 2 prior drug convictions, was sentenced to more than 15 years. 2 years ago, Terry sought to have his sentence reduced under the new federal legal framework. But the lower federal courts said minor offenses like his had been excluded from the congressional reform measures. More from the Supreme Court today with Associate Justice Clarence Thomas and the U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Eric Fagan.
Mr. Fagan, you suggest that there's no real difference between A, B, and C. But what's changed in A and B?
So, Your Honor, to the extent anything has changed in A and B, like to the extent that...
No, just in the language.
There was an amendment to A and B to the drug quantity thresholds for.
Okay. Now, what language changed in C?
New language changed in C, Your Honor, but of course C is textually linked back to A and B by the except as provided otherwise in A and
B. Okay, but in A and in a sense, A and B are linked too, but the language changed, the amounts changed, but the language in C did not change, right?
That's right, Your Honor. Although on this point, I think it's quite relevant that Congress did not use a word like amended, which it would have been well aware was a word it could have used because it appears in
the... So what's the difference between modify and amended?
I think modified has a broader connotation, and Congress used it deliberately because it's not the language of Section 2 of the Fair Sentencing Act, which we know it was looking at.
That from the U.S. Deputy Solicitor General and Justice Clarence Thomas. The case, Terry v. United States, a Supreme Court ruling. It's expected in June. Finally, on this date in 1970, the shootings at Kent State University, also known as the May 4th Massacre. It was a tragedy that claimed the lives of four people. In 13 seconds, Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandy Shearer, and William Schroeder died. From NBC Nightly News, 51 years ago tonight.
Two young men and two young women were killed, and at least a dozen other students were wounded. It took university officials 2 hours to disperse the students. Then the university was closed for the remainder of the week. The guard has sealed off the city. Assistant Adjutant General Frederick Wenger said later the guardsmen did not open fire until after they came under sniper fire themselves. Governor Rhodes has asked FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to investigate the shootings. Fred DeBrine, NBC News, reporting.
An anti-war movement during the height of the Vietnam War on the campus of Kent State University 51 years ago today, May 4th, 1970. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And all of our coverage available online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.